Return to Northmoor, Episode 10, running time 33 minutes.
Hi, this is Kim.
And this is Tim.
Welcome to the Return to Northmoor podcast. Tonight, we're going to be talking about the characters entering the Temple of Art.
The Temple of Art, the first big dungeon crawl. We're finally almost there. The characters have gone to the Blood Temple and retrieved the Blood Keys, and have come back to the Bogman's hut to have some grub and sit around a fire and hopefully recover their strength before heading out in the morning to the Temple of Art and to face the evil Kumat.
The ghosts have left for the night and will not be there for more questioning. The Bogman will be happy to answer any questions, especially about the mentor's history, the party the mentor was in with the Bogman, those kinds of past issues. The characters can also take this opportunity to do some role-playing amongst themselves. We ended up talking about one of our characters' reluctance to show that he was of noble blood.
This is also an opportunity for them to talk about the rods and the coins and what does that all mean, what the Sahuagin are doing, what the mentor situation, all that stuff.
This is also a perfect opportunity to talk about the dangers of the bog. They can hear sturges off in the distance, they can hear crocs crawling around the hut, whatever kind of bog-like dangers you'd like to emphasize.
Right, so as they're sleeping in the hut that night, you can have sturges buzzing around outside, that sort of thing, to just remind them that this is not exactly a safe place to be hanging out.
Prior to the ghosts leaving for the evening, they will be able to give some information regarding the Kumat. They can tell the characters that the Kumat is a semi-intelligent humanoid crocodile from the Feywild, and he loves to eat humans and elves. I think Aladrin's are off the hook on that one.
No, he's from the Feywild. That's his normal sort of snack.
He's also very attracted to places of power, which one could presume that the Temple of Art is.
Yes. You also, at this point, need to double-check your PC's equipment. We're doing the double XP progression, and if you're following along with that, then you need to make sure that they have got appropriate magic items for their level at this time. So take a look at the treasure parcels for level 1 and make sure that they've gotten all that stuff. Hopefully, at least most of your characters should have some sort of magical item by this point. In my case, I gave the warlock a wand, and I think I handed out a holy symbol just to kind of catch up for stuff that hadn't been able to get handed out up to this point. And the way that I handled that is the Bogman lives in the bog. There's all kinds of stuff floating up from the ancient city below that he happens to stumble across. He's got a few things hanging out in the back of the hut.
The next morning, the characters will be able to get on a boat and take about a 3-hour boat ride from the Bogman's hut deeper into the swamp. Just remember that the ghosts want the PCs to cremate their bodies.
And they'll remind them that they need to have their bodies cremated so that they can pass on to the next world and not linger here as ghosts.
The ghosts also do not know where the keyhole for entering the Temple of Art is. They never had to use it in the past. It wasn't something that was commonly in use during their time.
At that time, the Temple of Art was open to everyone who loved art. It wasn't sealed or locked in any way.
So once they start getting through the swamp, then they are going to come to a landing area that's a bit off from the entrance to the Temple of Art. On their way, they're going to run into some ancient guards, who, by the way, are ghosts. This is going to be a little bit odd because the ghosts are going to appear to them on the path as ghosts. This is not meant to be a combat encounter with the guards, but there is a surprise lurking behind them as they're walking down the path.
The idea is that they'll be chatting with the guards, and the guards will sort of do who goes there type manner and say, hey, stop what you're doing, and you can't approach the temple, and so forth. They're really not completely aware that they're ghosts. They think they just kind of got knocked out during the big thing that took over the temple way back when. So they're still trying to guard it. But behind the party, while they're talking to the guards,
a snake crawls down and grabs whoever is in back of the party.
Make sure that you get a marching order before you send people off down this path so that you know who to snag with the snake from the back. And play up the fact that the trees are very tall and there's kind of moss hanging down.
It's your typical swamp.
Yeah, the snake kind of slithers down from one of the branches, wraps itself around the rear character, and pulls them up into the tree for munching.
The Sahuagin did not come this way, so you're not going to find any evidence of their passage through. If the PCs ask the guards about the keyhole, they know that it is hidden in a bas-relief that depicts the symbol of Arathis.
So even though the ghosts who maintained the temple, Ramadal and Alanada, did not know where it was, the guards, since they were responsible for temple security, did know where the keyhole was. So if the PCs happen to bring it up to them, or depending on how the interactions go, maybe the guards will let it slip, they'll indicate that in this bas-relief of the symbol of Arathis in the room, there's the keyhole that they can put the blood key into to gain entrance to the temple.
If your characters are having a hard time getting this kind of information, you can also have them roll a DC 14 diplomacy check so that they can get that information, because it will be important in the future.
It all depends on how your group goes, whether they're a talker or a roller.
One of the things that the guards will be able to communicate is that they saw a lot of people running around them with multicolored cloaks before their death. Now, they don't really think that they're dead yet. They believe that they were just knocked unconscious, so they're not really aware of the current time, as Tim had said.
These people in multicolored cloaks are part of the chaos cult that ended up destroying the entire Balalakwan civilization on one night of massive chaos, and more will be found out about that as time goes on.
Keep in mind that these guards will fight if attacked, though.
So in the write-up, I have provided stats for both the guards and for the snake. I'm not going to go over the stats for the guards since it's very unlikely that they'll fight them, but they're there if you end up having a situation where you need them. So let's go over the stats for the Bog Crusher, who's the giant python of doom. Imagine the python from the original Conan film that he wrestles with in the wet pit. That's the size of snake we're talking about here. It's a level 3 lurker. Now remember, the characters are level 2 at this point, so this is a little bit higher level than them, but it's only one creature. So it's more of a dramatic thing than a real major threat. It's got initiative plus 7, perception plus 7, and low light vision, so making it early morning dawn with all sorts of moss hanging down and so forth makes it nice to have that dark area. 41 hit points, AC 17, Fort 16, Reflex 15, Will 15. It's a little bit hard to hit for second level characters. I actually toned it down a bit from the original that I ran, where it was the full level 9, I think it was, creature.
He kicked our butt.
You know, it's interesting. Again, this is a lesson. The XP works out, but the defenses are so high that it just becomes a very frustrating encounter. So it's speed 6, climb 6, swim 6. It can deal with whatever kind of terrain comes at it. The main attack is a bite, which is a standard at will, plus 8 versus reflex, 1d6 plus 3 damage, and the target is grabbed until escape. Since this is a constricting snake, it'll follow up with a constrict, which is also a standard action, so that means it can't do it till its next turn. And anything that the Bog Crusher has grabbed, plus 8 versus fortitude, 2d6 plus 3 damage, and the target is dazed until the end of the Bog Crusher's next turn as you start to pass out from being crushed.
That presents a problem.
Unless the creature that gets grabbed is an Eladrin that can teleport out of its coils.
Wait for it!
It does have stealth plus 7, so it should be able to sneak up on the character in the back. It can be a stealth versus perception as to whether they notice. Frankly, I say you don't even roll it unless they have a really great perception and should be noticing such things.
That, or if somebody's actually saying, I'm watching our back.
In which case, that skill is there to help you out.
So hopefully your characters make it beyond the snake, and they actually get to the entrance to the Temple of Art and meet up with the Kumat.
The Kumat has camped on top of the entrance to the temple. The temple has sunk below the level of the swamp, so there's a big pit that leads down into the entryway of the temple, and the Kumat has essentially camped on top of this pit. Now, it's an island in the bog. You can set it up a lot of different possible ways. We'll get into that in detail in just a minute, but essentially the Kumat is hanging out on this island.
So the Kumat has been bribed by the Sahuagin with bodies of the soldiers that they had kidnapped from the outpost earlier. If the PCs take a look, they will see that the mentor is not there. The Sahuagin have found that the mentor is of noble blood, and they need him for the rest of the adventure.
The rest of the soldiers they kidnapped from the outpost are no longer necessary, so they gave them to Kumat for a snack.
They also were poisoned, because the Sahuagin are planning kind of creatures, and they decided that they want a way to get out of there, and they don't want to have to deal with the Kumat on the way out.
They were a little concerned that the Kumat might forget their little deal on the way out, and this way he's probably going to not be dead, be a little hurt by the time they leave.
So the bodies of the other soldiers had been poisoned, and you can choose how much poison the Kumat has been able to eat to help balance this encounter for a large group versus a small group.
Right. If you have a big group, he hasn't eaten hardly any. He's barely poisoned. If you have a really little group, he's eaten a whole bunch and is already quite hurt.
So we have provided a map, as we usually do, from Skeleton Key Games. And you will notice that the foliage on the map are very tall but narrow trees. So there's no hiding behind them.
Hanging from these trees are these poisoned, half-chewed bodies of these soldiers. Now, among the moss and the trees and so forth, it may not be immediately apparent what's hanging from the trees, especially if they don't run up onto the island to immediately check out what's going on. So it's a DC 20 perception check unless they're right on top of the bodies to recognize them as the kidnapped soldiers.
Once the PCs recognize that those are bodies hanging from the trees, they would be able to recognize the soldiers from the outpost that they had either served with or were coming in as they were leaving. There is a very large hole that leads down onto a stone hallway that is going to the entrance of the Temple of Art.
If they fall down this hole for some reason, for example, by being knocked back from the Kumats attacks.
Or being fools.
Yes, or falling, as the terrain will be very slippery and boggy. It's 1d10 damage if you fall down in the hole.
Asahawagon has tied a rope to a tree and dropped it down into the hole, and it's still in place. So they will be able to utilize that to get down to the bottom.
And it's just a DC 10 climb check to come back up if they end up getting down there accidentally and want to return.
The ground here is mostly solid, but sections look like they could collapse at any time or become a quagmire.
And it's really up to you to decide how exciting you want to make that. My suggestion is that you pick a few areas to make very quagmire-ish, and then if the PCs happen to head into that area, then you have them get stuck.
One thing to note, and your PCs will probably ask, are there any dead Sahuagin in the area? And the answer is no.
That's key. If they've been paying attention up to this point, almost everything they've gone through there have been dead Sahuagin. So hopefully this will help them piece together the idea that the Sahuagin must have done something to avoid damage in this encounter.
And namely, they won't be able to tell that those soldiers have been poisoned to begin with, other than that they're just hanging there and are dead.
If they end up fighting the Kumat, which is extremely likely, since he's guarding the hole, then they end up investigating the bodies after that, they can do a DC 15 heal check to find out that the bodies have been poisoned.
So when you place your combatants onto this map, you want to decide what your group's grasp of the tactics are going to be, and then decide where you're going to place the Kumat.
This is to allow this encounter to be maximally flexible. If you've got an extremely tactical group who likes to sit back and plan, then you'll want to place the Kumat inside like a dark fairy ring so he gets +1 if he doesn't leave. Maybe they try to draw him out. You might put him right next to the hole so there's a maximum chance that when he knocks someone back with one of his attacks, they go into the hole. You might place him right next to one of the soggy spots, or you might have him hidden and not jump out until they actually get up onto the island. It really is going to be what you think will be the coolest for your group.
If your group is a bunch of smart D&D players, they're going to hang out and watch what happens for a while. Kind of get the lay of the land, find out what the Kumat is doing, and decide tactically how they want to address this problem. So you can let them kind of come in from any direction that they want.
One thing that might be interesting here is if they see him chewing on the bodies in the trees, they might think that those bodies could possibly be alive, and that might make them a little excited about running in and trying to save them.
One thing of note, that the Kumat is not going to leave the island in any way, shape, or form.
He really wants to be close to that power. He wants to be close to his food. He's not going to chase them off the island, and they're not going to be able to lure him off the island. So let's talk a little bit about Kumat stats. Again, you need to decide how many poisoned prisoners he's eaten. For each one that he's eaten, he'll take 5 hit points of damage per round, save ends. So that means as soon as he eats one, he starts taking 5 points of damage a round until he makes his save.
You need to decide this before the PCs start fighting it. That way it's an equal battle.
And that way you're not tempted to twiddle the hit points halfway through the battle. Go ahead and take a look at where your PCs are at, make a decision, start that clock ticking, and have those hit points start coming off. And then if the PCs decide to back off, maybe he'll heal up, or maybe he'll just die because he can never make a save.
Now the Kumat does have a special attack, which is the clamping jaws.
So it has a bite attack, which is reach 2 plus 10 versus AC, 1d10 plus 3 damage, and the target's grabbed till escape. The Kumat cannot make bite attacks while it's already got a creature grabbed because its mouth is busy, but it can use the clamping jaws attack. So what it's going to try to do is get within 2 squares of a creature, reach out, grab that bite, do the clamping jaws. So if it begins a turn with a target grabbed in its jaws, it can make an attack against that grabbed creature for +8 versus AC, 2d10 plus 3 damage, and even if it misses, it still takes half damage as you're being ground into its mouth.
Another special attack that the Kumat has is the tail sweep, which will become important with that big hole in the ground.
So it has a tail slash and a tail sweep. The tail slash is an immediate reaction, so whenever someone tries to attack the Kumon and misses, he immediately can tail slash them for plus 8 versus AC, 1d6 plus 4 damage, and the target is pushed one square. So that means he's going to push them out away from where he's at. Also, once per encounter, and then it recharges when he gets bloodied, he can use the tail sweep, and that actually is a burst, close burst 1, everyone who's standing around him. Plus 10 versus reflex, 1d10 plus 3 damage, and the target is knocked prone if it's medium size or smaller. Then a secondary attack, plus 10 versus fortitude, and the target is pushed 2 squares and knocked prone. So being pushed 2 squares and knocked prone with plus 10 versus fortitude, it's extremely likely someone's going down in the hole.
Additionally, remember that you can have a dark fairy ring hanging out in that area, and that's going to give that Kumat a plus 1
on all his rolls. This is supposed to be a tough encounter. It's a boss battle. It should be very difficult. As a result, you need to make sure that everyone's prepared for this to be a difficult encounter. Play up how scary this huge humanoid crocodile is, how tough he looks, how much everyone's worried about him being there, how the Sahuagin even didn't try to fight him. They bribed him off, that sort of thing.
So hopefully your PCs get through this encounter in one piece. More or less.
One last note, the Kumat does speak Common and Elven, however he's not terribly intelligent, so having a detailed conversation with him, his needs are pretty basic. He wants to eat humans and elves, and he doesn't want to leave the island. So if they've got humans and elves to feed him, they might be able to bribe him.
I don't think so.
Seems unlikely.
I'm hoping that you're playing with a good group. Hopefully, once your PCs have made it through this encounter, they will be entering the Temple of Art. And they will be doing that through that very large hole. Once they get down there, they are going to find a large room that is ringed with bas-reliefs of Belalaquan life. There are four columns guarding the door that leads into the rest of the temple. The doorway is utterly smooth and featureless. The columns, unsurprisingly, are beautiful women, and they are gold-tinged marble. Very noble-looking, very graceful.
Two rounds after the PCs enter the room, the columns will animate and slowly unfold. This is probably not going to be a surprise to your long-term D&D players, but play up how they're slowly moving and little bits of stone are falling off as they animate. In addition, you might mention that a few of them have kind of chips out of them here and there where they have been beaten up in the past. They'll slowly unfold, and they'll begin to dance with their swords still sheathed. They'll dance slowly and writhingly around the room, starting from their initial positions around the door. But they'll spin out larger and larger until their dancing is filling up the entire room. Just imagine 15-foot-high columns of marble dancing in a room that's probably 30 by 20. Yeah, that's pretty intense.
There's not a lot of room for the PCs to move around. Now, hopefully they will recall that they have a blood key, or two, or three, and that they will need to utilize that to get into the temple. The guards also gave them a clue as to where that keyhole was to be found.
So indeed, if they know where they're looking for, they can use a perception DC 12 to go and find that bas-relief of the symbol of Arathis, which does indeed have the small keyhole in it. If for whatever reason they don't know what they're looking for, maybe they fought the guards, maybe the guards got mad at them, maybe they didn't get the clue, then it's a DC 19 perception check to find it. And that is accounting for the fact that these columns are dancing around and so forth while they're trying to do this.
It's a bit distracting, I imagine.
Yes. The columns won't actually attack the group unless they attack the columns, in which case they will, without pausing their dance and without altering the flow of their graceful moves about the room, pull out their swords and start whacking on whoever attacked them.
So if you have some overachieving fighters, that might happen, because who doesn't like to fight these kind of columns?
Okay. In any case, they probably will not be fighting these columns. We're going to go over their stats here in just a second anyway, but the idea is they run in, they find the bas-relief, they put the key in, they turn it, and at that point the columns go back, they deanimate, the smooth, featureless door slides open, and they can proceed further into the temple.
One thing to note, that key better be filled up with blood, and noble blood at that.
Yes, if they broke it off the towel rack, then that's not going to work. So let's talk a little bit about the statistics for these columns. They are large natural animates constructs. This is a level 3 soldier, 49 hit points, Inish plus 5, perception plus 8, dark vision. Constructs in 4th edition have an interesting set of immunities. They are immune to petrification, shock.
Clearly.
Disease, poison, and sleep.
None of this should be a surprise to anybody.
Right, but what they're not immune to, and for all of you D20 3rd edition heads, they're not immune to sneak attack.
Or critical hits.
Or any of those other things that they used to be immune to.
Yay for the PCs!
Yes, finally, half your characters aren't totally useless when fighting constructs. A great thing there. They are fairly slow, speed 4, they are big walking stones. They have a stone longsword, which is again reach 2. Plus 10 versus AC, 1d10 plus 4 damage, and they have the cool power called Awesome Blow, which it can make a stone longsword attack. If it hits, it gets to make a secondary attack. That secondary attack plus 8 versus fortitude, and if successful, the target's pushed 2 squares and knocked prone. Do you get a theme going on?
So when Tim says Awesome Blow, I don't want any of the boys to be giggling in the background. No giggling.
And then, of course, when it's finally destroyed, it gets a fantabulous death burst. It explodes in a burst of jagged stones, close burst 1, plus 10 versus AC, 1d10 plus 4 damage, and the space that it used to occupy is now difficult terrain until it's cleared.
Kind of makes sense again.
Yep. I love the way that they did the carotid columns in 4th edition. They're easy to run, they're fun, they're still exciting, they do all the stuff you expect them to do, but they're not crazy hard to work with.
This pretty much ends the entrance into the Temple of Art, and after we come back from the break, we will be going over our reactions from the party and how we went through it.
Man, I could write a better novel than that. Have you ever thought this after reading a novel? Or have you always wanted to write but weren't sure how to get started? The Zero to Novel online novel writing course will get your creativity kickstarted. It provides a blueprint and tells you exactly what you need to be doing and how to do it every step of the way. From generating the right idea for you, to polishing it up and getting it ready to send to publishers. All delivered weekly to your inbox so you can work on it when it fits your schedule best. And all in less than 30 minutes a day. Support this podcast by clicking the link on their site and get started writing your novel today.
Welcome back. We are now going to go over some of the tips and tricks that we discovered while playing this adventure.
When you're at the Bogman's Hut, play up the role-playing. This is the major role-playing that they're going to be able to get in before they dive into the dungeon crawl, which makes up the Temple of Art. So this is their last chance to have a bunch of inter-party discussion, figure out what do they want to do with the Sahuagin, what do they think is going on, what do they think the rods and the coins and their old mentor and all that stuff has to do with all this. This is really the chance to play up that sort of role-playing. Also, if you've got characters who are priests of the Raven Queen and are not comfortable with this whole ghost situation, great role-playing can be had there. The Bogman can talk about the history and how he really hopes that they can do better than his group did and all that. So it's a really great opportunity for you to play up the Bogman and let the players do a lot of intra-party role-playing.
And depending on the history that the characters have with the mentor, you can really start pulling at some heartstrings and trying to figure out what they're going to do, what their plan of attack is, how they're going to address any of the combat challenges that are ahead of them.
Exactly. This is where you reach into that background that you developed back way back in Session Zero and pull that stuff out into the campfire discussion as they reminisce about old times with the mentor and how they really want to go rescue him and that sort of thing.
And recall that the characters have spent quite a bit of time in this bog area. So some of the creatures aren't going to frighten them as much as others. Kind of play that part up. Give them some things to think about. You know, there could be night hags out there. There could be larger than life-size crocodiles out there. There could be all kinds of nasty undead out there for all they know.
And again, this is your chance to push the danger of the Kumat and how powerful he is.
This is really, as Tim said, your only role-playing opportunity for this session. The rest of this session is rather combat-heavy.
There'll be some role-playing with the guards later on, but in terms of the party role-playing amongst themselves, this is it.
So speaking of the guards, once they get there, you really want to work hard on having the person who is talking to those guards be the person in front.
Remember, you're supposed to get a marching order before you start heading down this narrow strip of land. It's a big piece of dry land overall, but the actual part they're walking on is a pretty narrow strip between the water and this big giant set of trees and nasty underbrush and everything else. So they're marching single file down this chunk. Once the guards appear in front of the person in the front, whoever's interacting with them needs to be in the front, and that makes it much easier to have the snake loop down and grab someone silently in the back of the party.
Tim ran into a small problem while we were playing, because, of course, my character, being the wordy one, was in the back because the boys like to protect the girl, and she's the one who was talking to the guards.
Right. So I had to literally interrupt her while she's talking to the guards to say, a snake has come down from the tree and grabbed you, cutting off your final word.
Mind you, that wasn't that big of a deal because it tried to kill me.
It definitely did a lot of damage. And when you listen to the recordings, the snake is much more powerful when I ran it originally than I have written it up, because it did a lot too much damage too quickly, even though the XP totals worked out.
It kind of tried to decimate the party.
It was pretty tough. But then, of course, being a single creature, as soon as everybody in the party is shooting at it, it went down really quick. So there's no reason for that to not just happen anyway.
In a round, it tried to kill me.
But of course you got away because you teleported out of its coils, leaving it lost and confused and simply laying there to be a target for various arrows.
Also, the guards are not going to help you defeat the snake.
What I suggest you do is literally have the snake come down, grab someone, and pull them up into the tree so that either someone's got to go up in their tree to try to get them out, or they're going to be shooting at their friend who is wrapped with snake up in the tree. That will make this relatively low-powered monster last a lot longer and be a much more interesting encounter.
It also will be somewhat camouflaged and have cover by those trees as well. So moving on, once the characters get to the hole where the Kumat is hanging out, they have a couple of choices. They can either charge into battle. If you have some gung-ho folks, they might do that, which could end poorly. Or they can be wise and sit there and see the lay of the land, see what the deal is, especially if most of these characters are unfamiliar with the Kumat.
This is the first boss battle of the entire campaign thus far. It's the first solo creature that they will be fighting. It is essentially the first time they have to fight something that really has a very good chance of taking out one or more of them. So make sure they're prepared tactically to face that challenge.
They will be horrified to find that the bodies that are hanging in those trees are possibly some of their friends. So you need to play that up as well.
Ideally, they're sitting in the back. They're looking at what's going on. They see something in the trees. Maybe one of them sneaks up to see what it is, discovers to his horror that it's all his friends from the outpost, comes back, tells everyone else. They become outraged, and now they really want to take this thing down.
Also recall that the Kumat is poisoned, and you get to make that choice as to how poisoned it is.
Now, the reason that I gave this option is that when we were running it, we had a very small group. I wanted to make sure that this monster was still dangerous and powerful and tough, but I didn't want it to be one of these situations where they had no problem defeating it, except by the time they get it down to within 5 hit points, it's managed to knock out 2 of them. It becomes a TPK at that point.
Also recall that this is 4th edition, and part of the goal is to move around. This can be a very fascinating battle if you have a warlord in your presence.
And remember, the Kumat is shoving people backwards with his tail. Every time they attack him and miss, he does a tail sweep against them. So it's going to be a very dynamic battle. People are going to get flung all about. Play up the quagmire. Maybe there's spots you've decided on the map that are particularly quagmire-ish. They'll get stuck. Maybe they get slowed as a big chunk of mud comes up off their boot as they run out. This is where you can really make the terrain a hugely dynamic part of this battle. And that huge hole in the ground is a big part of that.
Take some time, really look over the Kumat stats, figure out how you want to play this. That tail sweep is an encounter power, but you get to use it twice, once before it's bloodied and once after it's bloodied.
Again, they'll think, oh my gosh, he's going to do this. He could do it at any time, but it's really like Dragon's Breath, where it's going to only happen a couple times in the encounter.
That is in contrast with the tail slash, which can happen as an immediate reaction to every miss that happens.
So the armor class on this creature is fairly low. It's only an AC 16, but it does have 164 hit points. These are level 2 characters. That could take a while, even with AC 16, especially if every time they miss, the thing essentially gets to attack for free against them. Once again, make sure they're tactically prepared. They're ready to run away if need be. If you've got a group that's not real tactically with it, maybe hasn't kind of melded as a group yet, or really it's just more casual type players, then go ahead and have it eat 3 or 4 of those poison bodies so there's not such a huge sack of hit points to cheer in through.
Something to also note with the Kumat is that it does have an aura of fear. So that aura is 5 squares around it, and the enemies within that aura take a -2 penalty to their attack rolls.
So its armor class is essentially 18 during this battle, which is going to make it even more difficult to people right up on it.
Unless they're hitting with ranged attacks.
Your goal is to portray what the characters are experiencing. As soon as you get up close to this thing, you're scared. Everything you do is just a little off. Whereas the people who are a little farther out, it's huge, it's moving around, it's relatively easy to shoot at. Play up what the characters are experiencing as a way for them to understand what they need to do different tactically.
And this is an odd creature. They've already went up against very large crocodiles in the past. But this is a crocodile that's walking around on 2 feet. So this can be a huge problem.
There is a D&D mini available for this from an older set. You can use that. We did. It makes it much more interesting to see it. An amusing factoid is that the Kumat mini actually is wearing a little loincloth. I'm not exactly sure what a humanoid crocodile has under that loincloth, but apparently they decided it was scary enough they had to cover it up.
We don't want to know.
That is the story of the Kumat. On to the carotided columns.
Now, this area is not meant to hurt your characters anymore. They should be wise enough and hopefully have listened enough to what the guards had to say when they were on their way to the temple, that they will be able to find that keyhole relatively quickly and not have to engage the columns.
But they should be tense. This isn't one of these, oh, we walk in, we're a little hurt from playing with the Kumat, well, you know, we got a little sore, but we've done a few healing surges, we're fine, we waltz in, we stick the key in the wall, we turn it, we walk in the door. No, there's huge dancing statues with awesome blow writhing around the room while they are trying to do this, which should make it a lot more tense.
And, you know, you might be able to limit their movement a little bit, make them have to dodge, make them have to roll around, acrobatics type of checks, those kinds of things to make it more interesting.
And you can decide based on your group's ability to cope with things exactly how you want to handle that. But having the statues move around, go ahead and move them around on the map and have the PCs have to move out of the way so that you can sort of indicate that. And if they're searching in a particular area, they may not be able to search there very long because a column comes along. It's like searching for a needle in a giant blender.
Also, remember they need to have that blood key prepared. It is crystal. It is fragile.
So once they've got the key in, they can turn it, the door will open. They can remove the key and the door will stay open for 15 minutes, even after they take the key out. The statues will collapse back in and deanimate, and they can head on into the temple.
At this point, the characters will have an opportunity to rest and get some healing surges done and really kind of take stock of where they are and what they're doing.
The statues do start to animate as soon as the characters enter the room. That said, if someone kind of sneaks in and takes a look around and scouts it out a little bit, the statues aren't going to animate until everybody's in the room or until someone actively starts looking for the keyhole. I just want to thank Luke Meyer from the podcast for his thoughts on some of the rewrites for this episode. In our next episode where we go through the actual play, you'll hear how things were quite a bit different than some of the things we laid out, especially for the final scene. And Luke and I exchanged quite a bit of ideas on how to tune it up, so I hope it works out better for you all than it did for us.
Yay! Thanks, Luke! So, if you have any questions, you can get a hold of us on our forums, which are at spookyouthouse.com.
And we hope to hear from you. If you have ideas on how you can make the encounters that you just heard even better, we definitely want to hear from you. Come and let us know, and then everyone in the community can benefit from your ideas.
And if you like this podcast, please go ahead and leave us a review on iTunes. I think we have 2 at this point, and it would be really cool if we had a couple more.
There's over 100 people that download this podcast every single week. In fact, it's more like 300 people. So we would like to get at least a few people rating us on iTunes so that other people are like, oh, this is a real podcast that people actually listen to.
Yay. So thanks a bunch, and we'll talk to you later.
Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Return to Northmoor, a podcast released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 2.5 license by Tim White and Kim Stone.
Our theme music is Charge of the Valiant from Dronalyn's Tower, Legends of Cithulain Volume 1, Tales of the Long Forgotten. Used by permission of its composer, David Alan Young. Find out more about their fantastic gaming music at dronalyn.com. Visit us and many other fine podcasts at spookyouthouse.com.